because unfortunately sometimes the tobacco people are talking to the tobacco people, the lead people are talking to the lead people. And what we really need to do, and what I hope this session will begin to make clear, is begin to have a collective discussion about strategies both for public health and within industries that have posed such serious risks and had such a dramatic impact on public health in the 20th and now the 21st century. So that's what I hope to do around the issue of tobacco. And I thought I would just start by saying everyone here, obviously, at an American Public Health Association meeting is completely aware of the dramatic risks that tobacco holds for the public. It's also quite well known, this is really a 20th and now a 21st century phenomenon, because almost no one smoked cigarettes as recently as 1900. So this slide just illustrates the dramatic, meteoric rise of this particular product. I don't have time to go into it now, but understanding the mechanics of how this behavior developed over the course of the 20th century provides us with potentially great insight into risk behaviors and how to potentially moderate them. We've also seen a dramatic decline in cigarette smoking, at least since the 1970s, and that's a giant story in public health as well. Even with this decline, smoking continues to constitute what most surgeon generals call the number one preventable cause of morbidity and mortality in the United States. This is data from 2003, but as you can see, cardiovascular disease, respiratory disease, lung cancer, all of the diseases that are tobacco-related are almost twice as many as diabetes, suicide, Alzheimer's, accidents, HIV, and homicides combined. So even today, when we widely perceive that smoking is in some ways managed as a health risk, it continues to comprise a gigantic cost to American society. And as I will mention later in my talk, now even more globally as well. So there's this tremendous paradox at the core of the tobacco issue. The product that we know best, that's been studied most intensively, that we most understand is a dire cause of disease and death, also is, I'm prepared to argue today, the single most unregulated product in the history of American consumer culture. So understanding that, I think, is the beginning of getting some leverage into the critical historical and public health questions associated with risk and its moderation in modern societies. Now, in some ways, you might say, well, the answer is easy. There's a big, powerful industry with deep pockets, and that explains why this particular product is so fundamentally unregulated at this point in our history. And I think that that's obviously true and a component of understanding it. But what I hope to do quickly is to show you some of the mechanics of unregulating tobacco that were utilized during the course of the 20th century, continue to be effectively utilized to prevent the appropriate regulation of tobacco, and now many of those strategies are being fundamentally utilized around any number of health risks in American society. Some people might say to me, well, tobacco's highly regulated. You know, just walking around a giant public space the way we all have today in the convention center, you would say, well, there's no smoking. And partly what I want to argue is that smoking as a behavior has come to be regulated. And obviously the industry opposed that because it has implications for the tobacco industry. But that the product itself, the cigarette, is remarkably unregulated, even now in 2007. And this is part of the story that I wanted to tell. The first aspects of regulation for tobacco after the turn of the 20th century, when some states did in fact prohibit the sale of tobacco, but tobacco really took off, and by the 1920s, those laws were gone. And the first serious federal efforts centered on the Federal Trade Commission and health claims that were made for tobacco in the 1920s and the 1930s. And the Federal Trade Commission, for example, raised questions with R.J. Reynolds for Camels or Lucky Strikes for American Tobacco and said, you know, these are health claims. You can't be making health claims about cigarettes. Even when these ads appeared in the early 1930s, some of my students think that the ad on your left looks a little bit like Franklin Roosevelt. That's a 1932 ad, Dr. New Deal. Even at this time, there was already rising health concerns about tobacco, but the industry was making health claims. They were also suggesting that there might be therapeutic benefits to the use of cigarettes. So the ad on your left says, for digestion's sake. And the Federal Trade Commission would send a letter to the tobacco industry saying you've made another health claim. And they and their attitude, now we have a lot of these documents, was, well, let's modestly modify the ad. There were a lot of ads during this period that said reach for Lucky instead of a sweet. The Federal Trade Commission said you're appealing to children, saying use cigarettes instead of candy. So they changed the ad. They just said reach for Lucky instead. And that was their response to the Federal Trade Commission. The ad on your right, Camels Don't Get Your Wind, show Lou Gehrig, many other prominent celebrities endorsing cigarettes. And many physicians at that time were saying, you know, if you smoke, you should cut back. So the industry was right on the edge of that. They would say, well, Camels are so mild, you can smoke all you want. And what I really want to suggest about these ads is we can read them closely to understand the mechanics of consumer motivation and the sensitivity with which the industry was responding to rising concerns as they emerged in the 1930s and the 1940s. Now, a lot of the attacks on regulation centered on what today we widely know as scientific disinformation and how to compromise the evidentiary base that, in fact, cigarettes cause lung cancer and other serious diseases. Today we all know what the term scientific disinformation means and we have some familiarity with these types of campaigns. What I would argue is that actually the whole notion of scientific disinformation was invented by the tobacco industry around the middle of the 20th century. Obviously other industries, and we'll see, were working on similar things, but the concertedness of this particular campaign, I think anyone would find striking. Now, by the 1940s, early 1950s, as you see, there were rising deaths associated with tobacco. But at this time, there were many questions, what's really causing this? And the question of what's really causing something right away opens up opportunities to undermine emerging data. I have here a slide of two of the principal early epidemiologists who developed the data which demonstrated conclusively that smoking causes lung cancer. On your left is Richard Dahl, who worked with Bradford Hill in Great Britain. I always have my students in epidemiology, but in history, public health, read the early Dahl-Hill papers. They're a brilliant representation of the logic of scientific understanding of causality that's really the foundations of how we think about public health today. Ernst Winder, when he did the early studies, was a third-year medical student working with a surgeon at Barnes Hospital in Washington in St. Louis, where the surgeon was a four-pack-a-day smoker and said, I don't believe that smoking causes lung cancer. And together they interviewed lung cancer patients, ultimately did prospective work, ultimately did work with laboratory animals exposed to TARS and were fundamental in a collaboration of demonstrating once and for all that smoking caused many diseases and death. But here's how the tobacco industry responded. They said, don't smoke is advice hard for patients to swallow. May we suggest instead smoke Philip Morris? And then I think this is especially important. They say, why not observe the results for yourself? On your left, it says eyewitness reports. It's one thing to read results, such as the Dahl-Hill reports, in a published research. Quite another to see them with your own eyes. May we suggest that you make your own tests? And what I'm suggesting here is that these were fundamental strategies for undermining the notion of population-based data that the industry would utilize at a time that the emergence of these ways of knowing would become very powerful. The other thing they were doing was to appeal to clinicians, and they were saying, you know, this is really the doctor's decision. The doctor should decide what's best for his, not really his and her, but his patient. And so they had ads like these: more doctors smoke Camels than any other cigarette. The ad on your left appeared in Life magazine. The ad on your right actually appeared in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And these would always have glowing portrayals of the physician. And what the companies were saying is, this must remain within the domain of clinical judgment as opposed to population-based science. Now, I was able to do a little research on this campaign when I was working for the Department of Justice in their fraud and racketeering case against the tobacco industry. And what I was able to find out, because of the profusion of tobacco documents which became available as a result of litigation, was that R.J. Reynolds hired an ad man, and he would go to medical meetings, like the meeting of the American Medical Association, and they would hand out packages of Camels in the doctor's hotel rooms, but also in the lobby and other places. The next day, they would send in what they would call an independent survey research organization, and the survey research organization would say, "Doctor, what brand are you carrying?" And the doctors would fish into their pockets, pull out a pack of Camels, and on this basis, they came up with this campaign, "More doctors smoke Camels than any other brand." When I was telling this story in a deposition, one of the lawyers got very antsy. He said, "We're going to move on now, Dr. Brandt. We've heard enough about that." They really don't like hearing this particular story. One of the things that they did was product modification, making new health claims. And this is one of the things: if the product is under fire, change the product. And we could talk more about that in the current context, where so-called harm-reduced cigarettes are really on the possible horizon. But this has been a classic industrial strategy. If the product is under suspicion, you merely say, "Well, we've changed it." And so here you have Chesterfield saying nose, throat, and accessory organs not adversely affected by smoking Chesterfield, first such report ever published about any cigarette. And here's Frederick March offering just what the doctor ordered, the L&M Miracle Tip Filter. This has a letter from Dr. Darkus. I did a little research into Dr. Darkus. He was actually a research chemist for a consulting research firm that Liggett and Myers hired at the time. I found one document during this period from R.J. Reynolds from a researcher named Claude Teague. He said, "We've been doing research on filters, and we've found that by varying the pH in the filter, we can make a change to any color we want. But we've found in research focus groups that if the filter changes to yellow or brown, consumers believe it's more effective." The letter goes on: "Unfortunately, these filters are not removing the carcinogens which we have identified in our laboratories. Nonetheless, I believe there are important patent opportunities in varying the pH of our filters." 1953. The other thing the industry did is they decided, well, with great, I would say, brilliant public relations consultation, that in an instance where the science is demonstrating the harmfulness of your product, don't deny the science. Say, "We need more science." And this is what the industry did starting in 1953, 1954. And what John Hill of Hill & Knowlton advised the CEOs of the companies is, say, "We are going to get to the bottom of this. We need more science. The science right now is uncertain. There's a controversy. We have to do more scientific work." They hired this very distinguished biologist, C.C. Little, and he set up, with the public relations firm's help, the Tobacco Industry Research Committee. You'll see there on your left, the left scientist is a pharmacologist named McKean Cattell. And some of you may not be able to see, but he's actually holding a cigarette in this photograph of the Tobacco Industry Research Committee. They would give out grants for things that had nothing to do with understanding the health impacts of tobacco. But it then was a way of getting universities, other independent researchers, to become dependent on tobacco funds and therefore compromise their ability to speak openly and forcefully about the harms of tobacco. And many of our institutions, I would suggest you go back to your home institutions and ask them, does our institution take tobacco money? You'd be quite surprised to find that even today, most academic institutions are still taking tobacco money. And what they say is, but we're not doing research on tobacco and health. We're doing genetics research. We're doing cellular biology. But when these institutions take tobacco money, it limits their ability to speak clearly about the public health issues of risk and harm. This was the Frank Statement, published in 450 newspapers, January 1954, and it says, among other things, we accept an interest in people's health as a basic responsibility, paramount to every other consideration in our business. We always have and always will cooperate closely with those whose task it is to safeguard health. And obviously, this document became a key document in much of the litigation because it was seen as a guarantee that the industry would actually work on behalf of public health, even though we now understand it clearly as a public relations document. Yikes, 5 minutes, or however long. We'll do it in 5 minutes. The kind of documents you see is this one that's quite well known. Doubt is our product, since it is the best means of competing with the body of fact that exists in the mind of the general public. It is also the means of establishing a controversy. Controversies and uncertainty undermine any kind of regulatory momentum, any kind of political will for serious regulation. Industries understand it. In my mind, the tobacco industry understood it precisely and developed the strategies for exploiting scientific epistemology, uncertainty, and controversy. The idea of skeptics were crucial to the idea that we can defeat regulation. I'm going to move quite quickly because I do want to introduce just a couple other points. The industry perfected the idea of let's use regulation in our interests rather than always oppose regulation. And they did oppose many regulations, but what this says is now we actually want labels on the package. The first labels were celebrated as a triumph of public health. We now know smoking's dangerous. We're going to put labels on the package. Surgeon General Luther Terry said, smoking causes lung cancer. After a year of congressional debate, the first label said, caution, cigarette smoking may be hazardous to your health. But we now know that that label was put there at the behest of the tobacco industry. Their lawyers had advised them, the best thing you can do to avoid the potential avalanche of litigation is to get a label on the package. And after that, we will always argue. In the face of this controversy, which everyone is aware of, smokers have made their independent, autonomous decisions to continue to use our product. And this would be a crucial aspect of both undermining regulation, at the same time it would undermine litigation. All of these pieces of major legislation exempted tobacco. There would be a codicil at the end of each of these laws saying tobacco is excluded from this legislation because the industry brilliantly used special interest lobbying, developed the Tobacco Institute beginning in 1958. The first three presidents of the Tobacco Institute, two congressmen and a senator who were retired but now were back in Congress advocating for these kinds of things. I was just going to mention this Federal Hazardous Substances Act of 1960. In 1974, a senator from Utah, Frank Moss, said perhaps we could use the Federal Hazardous Substances Act to restrict high-tar tobacco products. And so he writes to the Consumer Product Safety Commission, and he says, these products have been demonstrated to cause disease and death. The Consumer Product Safety Commission, because of interstate commerce, should now restrict the movement of these particular cigarettes. Well, the CPSC wanted none of it, but he went then with the APA to a federal district court judge who ordered that, in fact, the Consumer Product Safety Commission has authority to regulate cigarettes. And the judge ruled that, in fact, that they did. So the following month in Congress, a bill was passed saying that the Consumer Product Safety Commission does not have authority over tobacco. Signed by Gerald Ford, 1975, no fanfare, very little press coverage. I'm going to move quickly. These are the current labels, which most smokers don't even notice anymore, completely diluted. There has not been a piece of federal tobacco legislation in the United States since 1984. Now, this was the key document that described their strategy. It said, create doubt about the health charge without actually denying it, advocate the public's right to smoke without actually urging them to take up the practice, encourage objective scientific research as the only way to resolve the question of the health hazard. Tobacco Institute newspaper ad, the question about smoking and health is still a question, 1970. These are the websites for the documents. I really urge you, no matter what field you're working in, to get a look at the documents, because it's a remarkable story of the most secretive of industries being completely exposed as a result of litigation. There are 40 million documents, all searchable by text on these two sites. The final thing that I want to suggest is that cultural ideals undermine public health and regulatory efforts. And in this sense, the idea that individuals would be responsible, should be held responsible, undermines the regulatory ethos. But the industry would appeal to other ideals as well, like, well, public health people are health fascists. Where does the term health fascists or health Nazis come from? If you put health fascists or health Nazis into the tobacco website search, you'll see we need to use terminology like health fascists to identify how to undermine regulatory efforts. Come out slowly, sir, with your cigarette above your head. These were the industry executives, 1994. We do not believe that smoking is addictive. We do not believe that smoking causes lung cancer. The Department of Justice began to investigate them for perjury, but because they had inserted the term belief, they were spared criminal perjury charges. And of course, there's Koop and David Kessler, who tried to develop a momentum for FDA regulation. This is Joe Camel. We now know a lot about this campaign. RJR knew that young people were not smoking Camel cigarettes or any of their brands. Most of RJR's patrons were smoking Winston and Salem's. They were 55 and older. They were dying or they were quitting. And RJR said, we need replacement smokers and we need to get into the youth market. I was watching this campaign and I kept asking, how come they're going with this campaign when it was taking so many hits in the media? But they were weighing the risks of possible regulation against the need to get into the youth market. And Camel cigarette sales soared following this campaign. Now, people might ask, where's the Camel campaign now, the Joe Camel campaign? And it's not gone as a result of regulation. It's gone as a result of litigation and the Attorney General's agreements with the states. And so one thing about the three of our discussions this morning, this afternoon, is that litigation is often a sign of regulatory failure. So when we see litigation occurring, it often is a result of these kinds of unregulated harms and risks in our environment. I'm going to conclude just by showing you what's going on in the developing world. Because the last point I want to make is that when risks do come under scrutiny and control in one place, what we're seeing in a new global economy is those risks move. And it's almost like the analogy would be that of infectious diseases. We've always expected infectious diseases to move across national and geographic boundaries. But what we're now finding is that toxic risks or risky products are moving in similar ways as a result of what regulatory or cultural change reduces its consumption in one place. The industry is doing everything to undermine these kinds of warnings. 4 million people died worldwide of tobacco-related diseases in the year 2000. By 2030, it will be 10 million. But look at where the additional deaths will really occur in greatest numbers. It will jump from 2 million in 2000 to 7 million in 2030. About 100 million people died of tobacco-related diseases in the 20th century. But it's now predicted by the World Health Organization that if smoking rates merely stay where they are today, and uptake rates stay where they are today, 1 billion people will die in this century as a result of tobacco-related diseases. Now, this is the single most well-understood risk in the history of medical science and public health. So it raises a fundamental question of capacity, regulatory and public health capacity, in the face of very powerful industrial and economic interests. So let me just introduce you finally to the child on your left. This is Sergey Myrov, who was photographed by a Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer, John Kaplan, in 1993. And Myrov, he had a chance to talk to the boy. Myrov told him he only smokes Marlboros. Thank you very much.